of knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 631. It's me and Jason today, and this is potentially a part one. If you guys want a part two, we'll do the follow-on. This is going to be about the rise of the robber barons. When we say robber barons, it's basically the very, very wealthy that mostly early in the 1900s began to control everything. You've heard of them, the Rockefellers, the trains, shipping magnates, all kinds of things, which we'll cover. I guess before I say more, we'll jump in. Welcome, Jason.
And a hot good afternoon.
Oh, actually, this is coming out before our live stream. So I should announce there's going to be a YouTube live stream at Crow 777 YouTube channel. That is going to be on the 13th, June 13th at 7 p.m. in the evening, Eastern Standard or New York City time. Again, that's June 13 at 7 p.m. in the evening, East Coast of the United States time. Anything to add, Jason?
No, be there or be square.
All right. You want to say anything about these notes before we jump?
So anyone who's familiar with the history of the robber barons will know that there were quite a few of them. In this episode, we are going to be doing Cornelius Vanderbilt and John D. Rockefeller, and they were chosen for their specific fields of what they were able to make huge monopolies out of. But there are plenty of others, and like we opened with, if people like this, there are certainly plenty more we could get into in a part two.
We should also note that so much of the world that we're not thrilled with now, this is some of the roots of that. Not the roots of the families and the bloodlines, but the roots of the business practices that have basically turned the world into a monopoly. We've done the episodes where we try to show how many corporations own pretty much everything, if it's a service of some kind. And I mean pretty much everything. And that includes entertainment and sports, all of it. Back in the day, I think Jason was of a mind there were five corporations. Back then, I was of a mind there were two, but we both agreed that it really doesn't matter because all the board members of these massive international conglomerates, they're all in the same clubs, Club of Rome, Trilateral Committee. You know, they're all rubbing elbows in these off-the-books, public not invited, I guess I'll just call them clubs. And to me, this is the definition of monopoly, but we'll get into that as we go along.
Robber baron is a term that is used to define a person who has become rich through relentless and often unscrupulous business practices. This is normally used in reference to multiple prominent United States businessmen in the late 19th century and into the 20th century. This is particularly in reference to what is called the Gilded Age, which is considered to have been from roughly 1870 until 1900. These individuals amassed significant wealth and influence through industries like railroads, steel, oil, and banking, often employing rather ruthless business tactics, monopolistic practices, and political manipulation.
As a matter of fact, they are celebrating their wild success on HBO right now with a show called The Gilded Age. Now, I'm not certain. I heard there was going to be a season two. I think I heard that it was coming soon. Don't know if that's true, but I did see a little bit of season one, and it is absolutely whitewashing the amount of power these people had. The storyline puts a juxtaposition between the old money, I guess, from Europe and the new money in America, and how the new money wormed its way into the European aristocracy because they were so wealthy. But underneath everything we're about to talk about is the idea of monopoly. When I started to look up the antitrust laws and other things about monopoly, the thing that stuck out to me the most was early on in the 1900s, there were two major opportunities that were allowed to happen that allowed these families to grab damn near anything they wanted. I'm talking railroad, shipping. I mean, if it mattered and it was a service of some kind and they wanted it, they could have grabbed it. Early in the 1900s, there was a 10 or a 20-year period where it's claimed that monopoly wasn't enforced at any meaningful level. Later, Rockefeller gets pulled in for the monopoly idea on Standard Oil. And the way it is written is that the court judges must have been gotten to because it was defanged at some level. But even after all this, we have the Great Depression. And in my mind, that is, again, another opportunity where many wealthy people go broke, the average people have no money, and yet the robber barons had the capital and the open door to grab anything they wanted.
The first of the robber barons that we will cover is Cornelius Vanderbilt. He was born on May 27th, 1794, in Staten Island, New York, to a modest Dutch-American farming family. Cornelius Vanderbilt received little formal education and left school at age 11 to work on his father's ferry. At age 16, Vanderbilt borrows $100 from his mother to buy a periauger, which is a small sailing vessel. He ferries passengers and goods between Staten Island and Manhattan, undercutting competitors with low fares. This early display of aggressive pricing to capture market share is a tactic that he will refine later. During the War of 1812, Vanderbilt secures contracts to supply provisions to U.S. military forts around New York Harbor. His reliability and low bids earn him significant profits. In 1818, Vanderbilt becomes a steamship captain for Thomas Gibbons, who was a wealthy entrepreneur. He operates a ferry service between New Jersey and New York, competing against a monopoly that was held by Aaron Ogden. Vanderbilt undercuts Ogden's fares and defies legal challenges, which helps Gibbons win the landmark Supreme Court case Gibbons versus Ogden in 1824, which breaks state-granted monopolies under the Commerce Clause. In 1829, Vanderbilt leaves Gibbons to start his own steamship business, operating ferries and coastal trade routes along the Hudson River and Long Island Sound. He once again slashes fares to drive competitors out, then raises prices once he is dominant, earning himself a reputation for cutthroat competition.
So, you know, that we're talking people who must have good knowledge, maybe even be in the family lines of all the Dutch trading that went early on. And that is its own dark tale, all the way back to when they're trying to take over the Holy Land. But to come forward, another thing that gets unmasked here is we're talking 1812, and he's already getting in bed with the military. If you look back at the monopoly rules, laws, and antitrust, you'll find a whole place where these major corporations get involved with the military, and they simply get preferential treatment. And in many cases, they carve out a niche where they make the claim they're the only person who can satisfy the service that's needed. But anyhow, go ahead, Jason. We've got a lot.
Moving into the 1830s, Vanderbilt competes fiercely with the Hudson River Steamboat Association, which was a cartel of steamship operators. He offers fares as low as 12.5 cents, and sometimes even free, to lure passengers, which forces the association to lose money. By 1834, the association buys him out for $100,000, along with annual payments to stay out of the Hudson River market. This is also a tactic Vanderbilt will repeat elsewhere. In 1835, Vanderbilt shifts to Long Island Sound, competing with the New York, Providence, and Boston Railroad, the Stonington Line. He again slashes fares, causing financial distress for his rivals. In 1838, competitors pay him to abandon the route, further enriching him. In 1846, Vanderbilt returns to Long Island Sound, building faster, more efficient steamships. His focus on cost-cutting, like using cheaper materials and minimizing overhead, allows him to offer lower fares while still maintaining profits. He drives competitors, like the Stonington Line, into bankruptcy or submission. In 1849, the gold rush creates demand for transcontinental travel. Vanderbilt establishes the Accessory Transit Company to transport passengers from New York to San Francisco via Nicaragua, which is a shorter route than crossing Panama. He undercuts the Panama route's prices, capturing a significant market share. By 1851, his Nicaragua line is highly profitable. Moving into the 1850s, Vanderbilt's partners in the Accessory Transit Company, Joseph White and Cornelius Garrison, attempt to oust him by manipulating stock and bribing Nicaraguan officials. Vanderbilt retaliates by starting a rival line where he slashes fares, regaining control. It is attributed to him that he writes, "Gentlemen, you have undertaken to cheat me. I won't sue you, for the law is too slow. I'll ruin you."
Meanwhile, while he's doing similar things in another direction, but there's one glaring, reoccurring theme here. Somehow he's able, all the way back when they're claiming he borrows or gets $100 from his family and buys a little skiff, he's undercutting all the fares. Well, how's he doing that? And my guess is, Jason, that he had money and that the little $100 thing is meant to cover up the fact that somehow he had money either backed by the family or something, because time and time again, he's somehow able to run these things and undercut everyone else, which either means the other side was charging way too much, which is probably not true, because when he undercuts them, they go out of business pretty quickly, or they find themselves in dire straits. But the other thing that's obviously going on here is he's bribing other countries and he's grabbing that connection, or maybe a better way to say that is becoming familiar with these places and other countries. But go ahead.
The first railroad in the United States was the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, the B&O, chartered on February 28, 1827, in Baltimore, Maryland. It began operations in 1830 as the first common carrier railroad, designed to transport both passengers and freight. Initially, it used horse-drawn cars, but by 1831, it adopted steam locomotives, with the Tom Thumb being one of its early experimental engines. The first section, covering 13 miles from Baltimore to Ellicott's Mills, opened on May 24, 1830. In the 1840s, railroad mania sweeps Britain and the U.S., with rapid expansion of rail networks occurring in both nations. By 1840, Britain has over 1,500 miles of track, and the U.S. follows suit, fueled by land grants and private investment. Railroads will keep expanding at a rapid pace as the years go by. In 1850, the standard gauge of 4 feet, 8.5 inches becomes widely adopted in both Britain and North America, which enables interoperability between rail lines, though regional variations will persist. By the 1850s, railroads are considered the backbone of the American economy. And so, in 1853, Vanderbilt begins investing in railroads, recognizing their potential to surpass steamships. This is quite significant. He acquires the New York and Harlem Railroad, a small line serving Manhattan. He manipulates stock prices by spreading rumors and buying distressed shares, gaining control at low cost. 4 years later, the Panic of 1857 hits.
So, I mean, there are so many things that we are living with today you're looking at the roots of, and they flaunt it in the movies all the time. What's the DiCaprio movie about Howard Hughes?
That would be The Aviator.
Yeah, The Aviator. And it tells you flat out, but that, you know, we should do Howard Hughes someday, Jason, because there's a tale that they've worked mightily to obfuscate, to say the least. Anyhow, people are familiar with it. There's the story being told of a supposed magical man named Howard Hughes, who for some reason is in disguise all the time. No one gets to see him. He locks himself in hotels, pees in bottles. It's just a whole tale, whatever the truth is. He even makes it into a song, went to a garden party. Howard Hughes is referenced being in a disguise wearing Dylan's shoes in that, but that's not really the point. The point is that we are still harvesting what started here. So they start doing trains. Anyone can go back and look at the luxury. When they get up to planes, you can look at the luxury. Now they're undercutting us, right? To do these things now is poverty in comparison to back then. So it's almost like the same business practices are being employed in reverse against us, because we don't get travel at a luxury level anymore. And if we do, we pay out our nose. And even what we would consider luxury travel is a far cry from what once was. But again, the movie Citizen Kane is throwing in your face what we're talking about this. And how did he do it? He's backed by money. He can do whatever he wants. The old HBO film tells the tale in Deadwood, which is very violent. I'm warning you, for anyone who would go watch that. I mean, it's like dripping with blood. but they tell the tale of the main character that's not named in Citizen Kane, going to take over all the gold reserves. Lastly, you're seeing the gauge of railroads and all this be normalized, and then, you know, this country can share with that country. Never forget how the train was used in India by Britain. That was basically a weapon to help them control and take over Britain. To this day, I think the tracks that Britain laid are still being employed.
The Panic of 1857 was a significant financial crisis in the United States that triggered a severe economic depression, which impacted businesses, workers, and industrialists, including Cornelius Vanderbilt. It was the first major nationwide financial crisis in the United States, but certainly not the last. It was driven by speculative investments, particularly in railroads, and exposed the fragility of the U.S. economy during the pre-Civil War era. For robber barons like Vanderbilt, the crisis was both a challenge and an opportunity, as it allowed these kind of men to acquire distressed assets and consolidate their power. The event was kicked off on August 24, 1857, with the collapse of the Ohio Life Insurance and Trust Company, which was a major financial institution in Cincinnati. It failed due to embezzlement and overinvestment in railroad securities. Its collapse triggered a loss of confidence in banks and railroads. Stock prices plummet, particularly for railroads, as investors were rushing to sell. A domino effect ensued from there, leading to a depression that lasts until 1859. The financial crisis bankrupts many railroads, but Vanderbilt's New York Central remains stable due to his financial reserves and diversified investments. However, the crisis does provide the opportunity for Vanderbilt to buy struggling lines at bargain prices, enabling him to expand his holdings, including the New York and Hudson River Railroad.
All right, I'm going to put my point of view on this. We're looking at a man with Dutch roots. Does anyone recall the tulip market crash? There is a point in that part of the world when bulbs of tulips, we are told, yes, the flower, tulips, are so inflated in price that a single tulip bulb could buy a mansion or something like that. And I'm not kidding. You can look this up. This guy's from that part of the world. He had to have known about that and remembered it. I'm guessing his family was alive during it. It looks to me like Mr. Vanderbilt probably had his hand in doing this, willing to do a little damage to himself to take out everyone around him that he wanted to. That's my perspective on this, Jason.
Well, they still do the same kind of thing today.
Yes.
It's probably even worse today, really, because big corporations can make things a lot cheaper than a competitor can, than a small mom and pop shop, so they can easily defeat them. I watched it happen with something I'm quite familiar with, which is Guitar Center. They notoriously go into an area and their prices can beat the mom and pop music shops. So they end up not being able to compete with the giant corporation with lots of stores and plenty of buying power.
I think they're not even concerned about the courts. Let's look at Microsoft, the most modern version of monopoly enforcement or antitrust by the supposed courts in this country that I'm aware of, is Microsoft. It is claimed Microsoft didn't know that the internet was going to be a big deal, which is almost laughable. But having said that, they were supposedly losing the browser war, so they built it into their operating system. Since their operating system was pretty much a monopoly in the first place, the browser started to be looked at as a monopoly, and I think it was Netscape took them to court. But here's the rub. Netscape won. The courts ordered Microsoft to knock it off. And guess what happened? Netscape went out of business. So in my view, it almost appears, with knowing at the level that these guys have the ability to know at, if it forces them to court, they're still not very worried because they've got the capital and they'll come out on top either way.
By 1857, Vanderbilt is estimated to be worth $20 to $30 million and was diversified across steamships, railroads, and real estate. Unlike speculative investors, he had maintained significant cash reserves, which allowed him to weather the crisis. The panic underscored the risks of over-reliance on speculative ventures, such as steamships. So Vanderbilt accelerated his pivot from shipping to railroads as he recognized their long-term dominance in transportation. In 1859, Vanderbilt orchestrated a stock market corner on the New York and Harlem Railroad. The term orchestrating a stock market corner refers to a manipulative financial strategy where an individual or group gains control of the available supply of a company's stock to artificially inflate its price, which forces investors who have shorted the stock to buy it back at exorbitant prices to cover their positions. In Vanderbilt's case here, he buys up shares while spreading rumors of a city plan to revoke the railroad's franchise, causing a panic. Short sellers, which included New York City aldermen, are forced to buy shares at inflated prices to cover losses, which netted Vanderbilt millions of dollars.
There may be some version of what Jason just described in the HBO thing that's supposedly coming with a season two called The Gilded Age, where the railroad robber baron named Russell, in that telling, does a very similar thing to this.
Well, the tactic you're referring to was used by lots of these kinds of people.
Well, think about the tale we're told about how the Rothschilds come to be. It's a version of this, right? They have better information during a war. They spread the rumor that the English had lost when the English had won. By the time the English figured out they had won back in the marketplace, it was too late. He'd already bought up stock for pennies on the dollars. He owned it all. Same idea, spreading a false rumor.
By 1859, Vanderbilt was actively building the foundation for the New York Central Railroad. He applied lessons from his steamship business, emphasizing efficiency and cost-cutting. By 1859, he was upgrading the Harlem and Hudson River railroads with better tracks, locomotives, and scheduling to increase reliability and profitability. He standardized operations, such as track gauges, to ensure compatibility across his growing network, foreshadowing the integration that was needed for the New York Central. He used his already accumulated wealth, as well as profits from the 1859 Harlem Corner, to fund acquisitions and improvements. His cash reserves gave him an edge over debt-laden competitors. He did all he could to deter speculators and secure control of rail lines, ensuring he could merge them without interference. Vanderbilt also cultivated relationships with New York politicians to protect his railroad's franchises and secure favorable legislation. The 1859 Corner, which bankrupted aldermen who had been opposing the Harlem Railroad's franchise, ensured its stability. He leveraged legal precedents, such as the 1824 Gibbons versus Ogden case, which went back to his steamship days, to challenge monopolistic restrictions and secure operating rights for his railroads. Vanderbilt was envisioning a unified rail network that connected New York City to Albany, Buffalo, and eventually Chicago, which was a major commercial hub. This required merging smaller lines into a single system, a goal that he pursued aggressively going into the 1860s.
And if you think about it, is there a richer place? I don't know the answer to this, but I'm guessing it's no. Is there a richer place in the United States than connecting New York City with Chicago? And Chicago's making so much of everything as it becomes, well, I guess they call it the second city. That kind of tells you, New York being the first city, I guess. But that's where all the cash is, and he's getting a monopoly. And he's going to be the only game in town if he can get his way.
By 1861, Cornelius Vanderbilt was one of the wealthiest men in America, and he was now a powerhouse in both the shipping and railroad industries. On April 12th of 1861, the American Civil War begins, which would last until April 9th, 1865. The Civil War spurred considerable industrialization in the North, as the Union was in need of massive supplies of weapons, uniforms, railroads, and other goods. This demand would enrich the industrialists and entrepreneurs of the time. Vanderbilt certainly profited as well, as wartime contracts were rather lucrative, just like in the modern era. Vanderbilt would lease or sell steamships to the Union government for military use. His fleet, which included vessels from his Atlantic and Pacific routes, were used to transport troops to battlefronts, carry supplies, and support the blockade of southern ports. In 1861, he would also donate his personal steamship, creatively named the Vanderbilt, which was a 3,360-ton luxury liner that was valued at $800,000 to the Union Navy. The ship was converted into a warship to hunt Confederate raiders, such as the CSS Alabama. This act was publicized as patriotic, though it is quite likely that Vanderbilt was seeking favorable treatment for future contracts, which of course he got. He secured contracts to supply additional ships, often done at high rates. For example, he sold or leased older and less seaworthy vessels to the government at inflated prices, prioritizing profit over quality. Railroads, of course, were extremely vital for moving troops, munitions, and supplies to battlefronts, particularly in the Western Theater, like Tennessee and Virginia. Vanderbilt's control of the New York and Harlem Railroad and growing influence in the Hudson River Railroad made him a key player in Northern rail logistics. Vanderbilt's railroads transported Union troops and supplies from New York City to Albany and beyond, connecting to other lines for movement to the west. His lines also handled heavy freight, including weapons, food, and medical supplies, all of which were critical for sustaining the Union Army. Always working to expand his empire, Vanderbilt used his wartime profits to expand his rail holdings by buying shares in distressed lines. This built on his previous 1857 to 1859 acquisitions as he continued to exploit the economic volatility that the war was causing. Vanderbilt was also speculating in railroad stocks, buying shares in lines that had been weakened by wartime costs or mismanagement. He was likely using rumors and insider knowledge to influence stock prices, as he had in 1859, which helped him to ensure that he acquired shares at favorable prices. His financial clout also allowed him the power to lend money to struggling railroads, gaining influence or equity in return, a tactic that would later be used by another robber baron, banker J.P. Morgan.
So you're looking at the roots of a corrupt system that we were taught in school was set up by these magical forefathers, and freedom reigned and democracy this and democracy that. But if you boil down what we just covered, what it basically informs you is one of the best moneymakers, maybe the best, I don't know, but certainly one of the best is war. And that's not a single market. That is so many markets, from transportation to logistics to moving troops to, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And on top of that, almost certainly, it gives the person controlling the transportation a hand in what the outcomes of things are or how decisions are made. And when you can look at something like a market and comprehend that when a war breaks out, these guys are as happy as they can be, you have basically labeled what it is. It's evil. This is the inversion of what this world is supposed to be about, from my point of view. The life of a man or a woman or a living being should trump all this by a million miles, and that's not what's happening here. Money and markets are trumping lives.
In 1863, Vanderbilt begins consolidating his railroads, merging the New York and Hudson River Railroad with others to begin forming the New York Central Railroad, which was a major east-west network. He uses his control to set high freight rates while prioritizing his own shipments, enabling him to squeeze smaller competitors. His goal had been to create a monopolistic rail network that connected New York City to the Midwest, a vision he was now realizing with the New York Central that would see completion by 1869. Vanderbilt, flush with his Civil War profits, was now eyeing the Erie Railroad to complete his regional monopoly. The Erie Railroad was plagued by mismanagement and speculation. Its board, which was led by Treasurer Daniel Drew, a notorious stock manipulator, was known for financial chicanery. Drew was joined by Jay Gould, a cunning financier, and Jim Fisk, a flamboyant speculator, forming a trio that was determined to protect their control and profit from the railroad. The Erie Railroad ran from New York to the Great Lakes and was a key competitor, offering an alternative route for freight and passengers. Controlling the Erie would eliminate price competition and strengthen Vanderbilt's dominance. And so, Vanderbilt began to quietly purchase Erie Railroad stock through brokers with the aim of gaining a controlling interest. His strategy mirrored his 1859 Harlem Railroad corner, where he used stock purchases and market manipulation to dominate. He also leveraged his influence with New York politicians and judges to secure legal and regulatory support, ensuring his acquisitions faced minimal interference. By 1867, Daniel Drew sensed Vanderbilt's threat and, as Erie's treasurer, began issuing new Erie shares without proper authorization, which flooded the market to dilute Vanderbilt's holdings. This tactic, which is known as printing stock, was illegal but difficult to enforce in the rather lax regulatory environment of the 1860s. Vanderbilt continued buying shares, unaware of the extent of Drew's manipulation, driving up the stock price temporarily. His purchases cost millions as he aimed to corner the market, similar to his 1859 success. Drew then shorted the stock, betting on its decline once the new shares crashed the price, positioning himself to profit at Vanderbilt's expense. By early 1868, Vanderbilt controlled a significant portion of Erie stock, but not enough for outright control. Gould and Fisk joined Drew, forming a formidable alliance to protect their interests and exploit the conflict. Vanderbilt's brokers, who were unaware of the stock flooding, kept on buying, which cost him an estimated $7 to $10 million, or roughly $150 to $200 million in 2025 dollars. His attempt to corner the market failed spectacularly as he couldn't absorb the new shares. The Erie War became a public spectacle, with newspapers like the New York Herald covering the Battle of the Millionaires. The conflict spilled into politics as both sides bribed legislators to secure legal advantages. By late 1868, Vanderbilt realized he couldn't win control, shifting strategies to minimize losses and weaken the Erie indirectly. The Erie Railroad War was a rare defeat for Vanderbilt.
Does it sound like there's much honor or regulation or good old American apple pie and Chevrolet in any of this? I think what you see here is the sad truth that much of big business and the founding of this nation is a story like this, where there's nothing civilized about it. We're supposed to be a civilized nation, and this is dog eat dog. And where are any of the rules in any of this?
And with them messing around with the corporations like this, the railroads were essential to many people at this point. It's going to affect them.
I mean, when you own the transit, how is what we're looking at the railroad any different from airplanes today, as an example? Like right now, as we speak, for the third or fourth time, I forget, they're queuing up that if you want to get on an airplane, you've got to have a real ID. This is the same kind of monopolistic. That's not even the right word. It is a monopoly, but it appears not to be, because you can see, oh, how many airplanes are there? There's American. There's all these brands. But the truth is, which is shown in that DiCaprio movie, they all move in the same direction according to one another. It's control at a level where the things that have built modern society are dependent on the services that they control. And what's underscored here is money, as it always has been. They do whatever the heck they want at a certain level.
By 1869, Cornelius Vanderbilt was in his mid-70s and was one of America's wealthiest and most powerful industrialists, with a fortune exceeding $100 million, which is equivalent to over $2 billion in 2025 dollars. His railroad network stretched from New York City to Buffalo and connected to Chicago, and was a cornerstone of his monopolistic vision to dominate East Midwest transportation. At this point, Vanderbilt's railroads, the New York Central, Hudson River, and Harlem operated separate terminals in Manhattan, leading to inefficiencies in passenger transfers and freight handling. He needed a centralized depot to streamline operations and compete with rivals like the Erie Railroad and Pennsylvania Railroad. And so, he set about to build the Grand Central Depot. Vanderbilt chose a site at 42nd Street and 4th Avenue, which is now Park Avenue, in Manhattan, at the time a relatively undeveloped area. This location was ideal for connecting his rail lines and accessing the growing city center. Vanderbilt envisioned a grand modern facility to symbolize his wealth and the New York Central's dominance, being designed to handle millions of passengers annually and serve as a gateway to New York City. Construction began in 1869, with Vanderbilt personally overseeing the project's planning and funding. It was completed and opened to the public in October of 1871. The project cost approximately $6.4 million, or about $150 million in 2025 dollars, a massive sum that was funded by Vanderbilt's personal fortune and New York Central revenues. Because of his wealth, he was able to do this without significant borrowing. It was designed by architect John B. Snook and featured a massive train shed that was 200 feet wide by 600 feet long, with a glass and iron roof that was inspired by European stations like London's St. Pancras. The building included ornate waiting rooms, ticket offices, and facilities for three railroads: the New York Central, Hudson River, and New York and Harlem. The depot had the effect of spurring growth in Midtown Manhattan, transforming 42nd Street into a commercial hub. Vanderbilt's real estate investments around the depot further increased his wealth. The Grand Central Depot is considered a capstone of Vanderbilt's extensive career.
Not only was he one of the richest men living, he had magic at his fingertips. So he starts Grand Central Station in 1869, and 2 years later, he completes it, invites everyone in. That's a trick. Take a look. Look it up, what that building is. And for some reason, we just quit building that way, although I guess we couldn't afford to build that way, even if we wanted to now. But consider how much connection you have to be getting the rights of way and everything else that would go into pulling all those rail lines into a central area. The amount of power there is unimaginable.
By 1873, Cornelius Vanderbilt was 79 years old and his health was declining, but he was one of the richest men in the world, with a fortune that is estimated to have been around 100 to 105 million, or roughly 2.5 billion in 2025 dollars. Also that year, the Panic of 1873 strikes, starting from a stock market crash in Europe. This once again causes an economic depression, one that will last until 1877 in the United States and until 1879 in Britain and France. In the United States, the panic was known as the Great Depression, until the events of 1929 and the early 1930s set a new standard of just how bad things could get. The Panic of 1873 tested Vanderbilt's financial acumen and railroad empire, but it also provided opportunities for him to once again expand his holdings and solidify his monopoly. Unlike many railroads that were burdened by debt, the New York Central was financially stable thanks to Vanderbilt's conservative financing and operational efficiency. Other railroads were not so financially stable, with the panic bankrupting numerous railroads, with Vanderbilt acquiring struggling lines at bargain prices, much as he did during the 1857 panic. His most significant move was acquiring the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railway in 1873, which was a key link from Buffalo to Chicago. Vanderbilt also purchased smaller lines, such as the Canada Southern Railway, to bolster his network's reach and eliminate regional competitors. Because of his declining health, however, his son William Henry took a leading role in managing the New York Central. William oversaw acquisitions like the Lakeshore and implemented cost-cutting measures such as reducing wages, which contributed to already difficult times for many people. This set the stage for the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, a nationwide labor uprising against railroad tycoons, which included the New York Central. Regardless, William followed his father's playbook with consolidation, efficiency, and monopolistic control, ensuring the empire's resilience during the panic. Cornelius Vanderbilt dies on January 4, 1877, leaving an estate of approximately $105 million, the largest fortune in U.S. history at the time, most of which goes to his son. However, his will includes a $1 million donation to establish Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, seen as a rare act of philanthropy compared to later robber barons like Andrew Carnegie.
There are versions of this tale also in the HBO show called The Gilded Age, but in that one, they whitewash it and they make the robber baron Russell tell the National Guard to not shoot the people. So they're polishing a turd as far as I can tell. But Jason, I don't buy for a second that these great depressions are a thing that just happened. And the reason I say that is because follow the money. Just like a war, there are certain individuals who benefit tremendously. So what do you think? Did Vanderbilt have a hand in crashing the economy this time?
It's always a possibility, but do remember that at the time, the United States was on a gold standard. So why there were giant financial situations is a very good question. However, what I noticed going through all the historical facts on these situations is that they were trying to, almost like they do today, print more than they really should have, but they were doing it with stocks instead of money.
Well, there's another thing that strikes me as you do the mainstream outline of what the internet wants us to think is true of all this. And that is, like, he dies with, what'd you say, $200 million or something like that? That seems awfully low, particularly if you watch the shows like the one on HBO. There seems to be a lot more money than that. But think about trusts. There are plenty of trusts that apparently the rich people use that don't have to be identifiable, don't have to have a name or any easy way to track them back. And what I think is probably true is the $200 million is the public-facing money, and he's got many times that hidden off in other places, out of sight, out of mind.
Moving on, we're going to do John D. Rockefeller, who is widely regarded as one of the most influential and controversial robber barons of the Gilded Age, who was born on July 8, 1839, in Richford, New York, to William Avery Rockefeller, a traveling salesman and con man, and Eliza Davison, a devout Baptist. His father's dubious schemes, such as selling fake medicines, along with frequent absences, are said to have helped shape John D.'s disciplined and frugal personality. William Rockefeller was a bigamist who would abandon the family for periods of time, leaving Eliza to raise John D. and his siblings in poverty. This unstable upbringing fueled John D.'s drive for control and wealth, but it is also said that it instilled a ruthless streak. In 1853, the family moves to Cleveland, Ohio, and John D. attends Central High School, only to drop out to enroll in a three-month business course at Folsom's Commercial College. In 1855, he is 16 and lands a job as a bookkeeper at Hewitt and Tuttle, a commission merchant firm, earning 50 cents a day. His meticulous accounting skills and work ethic stand out, with his obsessive attention to detail and frugality, such as recording every penny in a ledger, hint at his later unrelenting pursuit of efficiency, which would often come at others' expense. In 1859, he partners with Maurice Clark to form Clark and Rockefeller, a commission merchant business that deals in grain, hay, and meats. The venture will profit because of rising demands that come during the Civil War. Interestingly, John D. avoids military service by paying a substitute of $300, a legal but controversial practice among the wealthy, with some later accusing him of dodging patriotic duty to focus on profiteering.
Of course he did. That tells you two things. It tells you that the people making the laws are viable because they have put on the books that rich people can buy their way out. And secondarily, how can you get a piece of the richest market in the world, which is wartime? This goes on and on and on, but I wanted to mention before we left the railroad magnates, I am utterly convinced that they had a hand in the death of the airships. I think the airships were too luxurious and too practical, and I would not be surprised to find out that the railroad magnates did everything they could to get rid of the airships. But coming forward to Rockefeller, when you read this, it's almost like, again, they're taking his story and polishing it to a high shine, everything we've heard so far anyhow.
And to finish out hour one, in 1863, John Dee has his first oil investment, putting $4,000 into an oil refinery with Clark and chemist Samuel Andrews, forming Andrews, Clark & Company. The oil industry is starting to boom due to kerosene being in demand, but it's a chaotic business with volatile prices. John Dee recognizes oil's potential, but is wary of its speculative nature and focuses on refining rather than drilling at this time. Early signs of his cutthroat nature emerge, though, as he negotiates favorable terms with railroads, squeezing suppliers to maximize profits. By 1865, he has a full commitment to oil and buys out Clark's share in the refinery for $72,500 after a tense auction, renaming it Rockefeller and Andrews. This marks his full entry into oil refining, leveraging Cleveland's rail hub status. The buyout is considered contentious, with Clark later claiming that John Dee pressured him unfairly, using his financial leverage to force Clark out. This starts a pattern of aggressive partner eliminations that will continue throughout his career. In 1873, John Dee partners with Henry M. Flagler, who was a savvy businessman, which strengthens the firm's operations. The company expands, building a second refinery called Standard Works to meet growing demand. John Dee also begins securing secret railroad rebates, lowering shipping costs for his oil while competitors are paying higher rates. While this could be called an unethical practice, although a common one, it certainly gives him an unfair edge. In 1870, he founds the Standard Oil Company in Ohio with Flagler, Andrews, his brother William Rockefeller, and another silent partner, Stephen V. Harkness. Capitalized at $1 million, it aims to dominate oil refining through efficiency and scale. From the start, John Dee uses predatory pricing, such as selling oil below cost to bankrupt his competitors, knowing his deep reserves can outlast smaller firms. This ruthless business strategy becomes a hallmark of his monopoly.
So again, it's the same story. They're painting one picture, but at the very end, they're telling you he's selling things at below cost. Well, how's he maintaining things? He had to have had capital backing him. That's the only conclusion I can draw. After all, let's look at the magical timeline. In 1855, at age 16, he's making 55 cents a day. And then 7, maybe 8 years later, in 1863, he has $4,000. That's a lot of money in 1863 to get in on the oil business. And then 2 years later, he has a full commitment to oil and buys out other competitors. I'm just not buying. There had to have been backing here. And why is it that when we're looking at the robber bearers, one of the main tactics we're being told here is they continually sell things less than cost? Well, that's all well and good, but how do you keep the lights on if you're selling things for less than you got them? Or even if you're selling them at the price you got them, to move them, acquire them, do all the things with the product and then give it away at the same price is still a loss. How do you maintain it? But Jason, anything you want to add before we wrap up hour one?
Well, my guess is he wasn't doing that with every single customer and every single transaction. He was probably doing it in certain key strategies. Everything these people did just seemed to be quite convenient, to say the least. But we are talking about a time before mega corporations existed, so they were kind of doing things where there weren't a lot of rules and regulations to stop them.
That's a fact. There was a window, and even when there were, it's pretty clear they were buying their way in. And here in this period of time, someone has gotten the lawmakers to go ahead and say it's legal for rich people to hand over $300, and then they can profit on the war instead of fighting in it. But what I see is patterns here. We're looking at two robber barons so far, and we're seeing the same tactic from both. It sounded like the first one may have undercut a little more than the second one, but nonetheless, if you're going to undercut as a leverage, that implies that you have capital to do so, at least in my book. But anyhow, I'm going to wrap up hour one if you're ready to do that.
We've got a long way to go with John D. in hour two, so we'll see you there.
Let me remind everybody, there is a Crow 777 live stream on YouTube on the 13th of June at 7 p.m. in the evening, East Coast time or New York City time. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode and they get access to all the comments and forums. They can create top level ideas. They can stream the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they like. That now has 10 awards, the last two coming from India, probably because of the Vedic ideas we covered in there. In Shoot the Moon, you'll find all my older telescope work to do with the moon, the lunar waves, UFO-y things, orb shooting plasma, the discovery of the second sun or the so-called second sun. On the website, you will also find stills that I have made available due to requests by subs. There's also going to be the 16th member solar video, and over the past 4 days, I shot the best video of the sun I have ever shot, and I'm busy producing it now. With that, we're going to wrap up hour one of episode 631, and I hope to see everyone logged in as a member for hour two. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.